This is CliffCentral.com.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, the 4th of December. Yeah, it's all happening. There's actually quite a lot going on. There's some very interesting things that have taken place in the world of journalism and of cartoonists. And, you know, we've spoken to a couple of these cartoonists. I had Zapiro on not so long ago. In fact, I remember speaking to him when he was going through a huge amount of trouble. It was probably 2 years ago, and he was really having a tough time because people were boycotting him. They were saying he was he's a bad person. Social media had turned against him, and we've had Germ on the show, Jeremy Nell. He's been a guest on this show a couple of times because he also has come up against the ire and wrath of social media. But there's so much more going on. It's so much more complicated than that. And he's been doing cartoons for a number of independent organizations, NGOs, businesses. One of them is OUTA, the organization Undoing Tax Abuse. And just the other day, I think Wayne Duvenacher was on with the Renegades on Renegade Report. So they're no stranger to you on cliffcentral.com either. But Germ is, it's interesting, he's just been fired by OUTA. Is that right? You've been fired by OUTA, Germ?
Hey, how's it?
Hey, man. Why did they fire you?
Hang on, sorry. I don't know if I was on live a few seconds ago. I need to read you now.
No, why did OUTA fire you?
Oh, well, it started with a story a couple of months ago in The Citizen written by its online editor, Daniel Friedman, a.k.a. Deep Fried Man, the comedian.
Oh, right.
It was kind of a hit piece on somebody else, and I was just somehow included in this mess. It had nothing to do with me. So I went to the press ombudsman with it, and the Citizen retracted their piece about me. No apology or anything, but that's fine. And then Daniel Friedman contacted me privately to ask questions about this whole thing, and I, civil, and I chatted with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was that. And then suddenly, over the weekend, The Citizen ran another piece about almost the same thing. But this time, from anonymous sources on Twitter with very libelous and defamatory claims about me, and completely untrue. And then kind of just very uncontextualized screenshots that were included in this piece. After that, the same people on Twitter, the same anonymous people, went to OUTA, because OUTA ran a campaign and they included a cartoon that I did for them. And of course, so some these same people got very upset about this and went straight to OUTA. OUTA then immediately, or within minutes, responded and said, no, they're going to kill their contract with me.
So in other words, they were bullied and intimidated by mostly anonymous and unknown and unimportant people into dumping on a relationship which was going really well.
It was quite a good relationship, yeah. I mean, I've got nothing against us. they fight the good fight, they fight corruption.
So hang on, Germ, I don't understand. Why,
I don't either.
Why did they do this? I mean, I thought that OUTA were good guys who stood for freedom of speech, diversity of opinion, and furthermore, not letting the bad people, and particularly mobs of bad people, dictate what they should and shouldn't do with money that is essentially contributed by members. It's not they didn't earn this money by going out there and selling things or providing a particular service. People contribute voluntarily, among them me.
Exactly. It's bizarre that they went according to almost entirely a single tweet from an anonymous person. I mean, someone is hiding behind a fake profile, making up fake claims, and then they somehow, an entire organization believed a tweet, or should I say believed in inverted commas, because, there could have been something else going on there, it's way too suspicious.
All right, how about the fact that Makosi Koza is now involved there? I think she's their chairperson, is that right?
Well, yes.
Okay, so Makosi Kosa is obviously a political animal. I mean, we respected the fact that she stood up to, very bravely stood up to Jacob Zuma and his cronies, particularly the ANC Youth League in KZN, and came under a direct personal danger when they threatened, and I think they did publish her home address, and the ANC Youth League in KZN were intent on hurting her children and made threats to that effect. She would understand how important it is to stand up for free speech. Is she not an ally in this situation?
Yeah, well, she's also made other racist accusation claims, for example, against Musi Mamani, in which she accused him of trying to be black.
Hasn't she since withdrawn those, to be fair? Hasn't she since changed her tune on that?
Yeah, but can't you say the same about cartoons that I've done in the past that get dug up?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the problem with you, you see, and tongue is firmly lodged in cheek. But you are, you don't carry the narrative that a lot of people like to have carried. You're not one of those cartoonists on the left-hand side who have the support of so many politicians and who engender and endorse a lot of the ideas that are popular among certain powerful media types.
Sure, and of course, going beyond, because there's probably, and I'm pretty certain, there's a strong, left type capture effect that's happening within Outer, which I think is causing a kind of dissonance, because what would traditionally have been a position that Outer would have defended in terms of this tweet making false claims about me, mm-hmm. has now gone in the other direction. And that leads me to think that there's definitely some sort of political swing that's happening inside the organization.
All right, so let's say people like me don't want to support Outer anymore. Good as their work might be in respect of things like e-tolls, let's say I don't approve of this position that they've taken. Can I directly contribute to you instead?
Yes, you can. I've tried an experiment called Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.
Right.
.com. And basically, like what William Shakespeare did, where individuals support creative people. Because they believe in the work that they do. Uh-huh. And it is working quite successfully. I've got nearly 60 patrons now. So someone is called a patron uh-huh. on Patreon.
Right.
And the URL is patreon.com/mynameisgerm. And if people want to support me, they can. But this is on top of my corporate work. But the longer term goal is to actually move away from any kind of reliance on media and organizations, so that I can be completely independent.
You can be supported by the people who support you, and you don't have to worry about institutional money or advertisers or sponsors or any of that stuff.
100%. So yes, 100%.
You're under My Name is Germ. My name is J-E-R-M, and I've just looked it up now, and it says Germ is creating politically incorrect cartoons. So if people wanted to support you because they believe in, I don't know, a different point of view, a diversity of opinion, then they can go ahead and do that.
Let's just say this quickly. People seem to misunderstand what politically incorrect means. It simply means going against a very safe narrative. A satire, remember, is not meant to be safe. It's meant to be irreverent. It's meant to get under your nose. It's meant to trigger you. It's not meant to incite violence. That comes from people who just don't understand it. And furthermore, just because it's politically incorrect doesn't mean that it's sexist or racist or homophobic, for example. Mm-hmm. It just means that it doesn't appeal to you. And editors of mainstream papers tend to avoid politically incorrect things because they don't want to cause too much controversy.
They want to sell newspapers, essentially, and they want to keep their advertisers happy. Okay, look, I understand that. That's business. But I'm kind of disappointed in Deep Fried Man, Daniel Friedman, who's the editor, the digital editor there at The Citizen, because I think that this is a weak position for him to occupy. He seems to me to be a guy who understands humor, who understands that not all humor is going to be politically correct, and potentially he's going to lose audience as a result of doing very bland, middle-of-the-road stuff. I don't know why he would be going after you.
I don't know either, but I think he's extending his comedy into his writing because it's a joke. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, you are. All right, well, listen, if anyone wants to support you, then they can go directly to you. Go to the horse's mouth. Don't worry about the in-betweeners. And go and support Germ. If you don't like what Outer's done by firing him as their cartoonist, and by the way, you draw for a lot of other people, so it's not like you're on the bones of your backside. But
No. In fact, I haven't done work with Outer for months now because of that last horrible hit piece on The Citizen. They decided they wanted to just take a look at what was going on behind the scenes, and then nothing further happened. It's not, as you say, it's not a major contract, which is fine.
Yeah.
But I'm just blown away by the support in social media. I didn't realize that that people actually saw this as a problem, and it's a good thing, because maybe it'll put pressure on other organizations in the future not to buy into fake tweets.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us this morning. Good luck with your excellent work in cartoons, and
thanks, guys.
We'll always support you. Thanks, man.
Cool.
Okay. There we go. There's Germ. I also heard this morning that a lot of the journalists, including Jacques Poe, who you remember being a part of this show not so long ago when we interviewed him around his book about state capture, which was really a book that opened up a hornet's nest on how much skullduggery is going on, and that was before it was widely known that there were things going on in SARS, there were things going on with this Mazzotti character who the EFF seemed to be intertwined with. Jacques Poe, a very brave man, came under direct personal danger, just like Makosi Kwaza, who I spoke about earlier, when he stood up to these forces. These are the brave people. I don't know why we seem to need reminding that we're not going to be saved by politicians, but we'll be saved by these brave journalists. So Jacques Poe and Barry Bateman of EWN and a number of others have been doxxed on social media. That means that people have gone onto social media and saying, please publish their addresses, the schools their children go to.
Oh, no.
Oh yes. Mm. Yeah, this is how disgusting and disgraceful the behavior is. Of, I would assume these must be EFF supporters who are smarting because Julius has been shown to be a supplicant of Adriano Mazzotti. They're embarrassed that their leader is just a servant again to some white dude with a cigarette empire. And they're embarrassed. So now they want to dox these journalists as if the journalists are the problem. And
I think it's all their fault.
That's so cowardly. And I think it's the worst thing that we can imagine, where journalists are intimidated for reporting on stories that are A, true, and B, in the public interest. So again, if you can support those people, if you can support Jacques Poe and Barry Bateman, you'd be doing South Africa a greater service than if you supported Julius Malema.
Greg.
Yeah. Because how's any of that really helping the situation?
Well, it's putting these people and their children... I mean, what kind of a craven person goes after someone's children?
Regardless of...
That's outrageous.
Which side of the wall you stand on, what is that helping?
Well, I will continue my analogy from yesterday, and I'm absolutely sure that I'm not the only one who sees this. If you read any history books, you'll remember that this is what the Nazi Party did in the 1930s in Germany. They would go after journalists, they would go after Jewish businessmen, they would shatter the windows of businesses, later on accost and violate and assault people who were perceived by them to be their enemies, whether they were communists or Jews or capitalists or whoever they might have been, because the Nazis had lots of enemies in the beginning. The longer you let this continue, the higher the price will be that you have to pay to stop it. And this is not how a political party behaves. This is how fascist gangsters behave.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to watch out for this stuff because it creeps in. And before you realize, you're being transported to gulags and to concentration camps. And bad things are happening and you can't stop it. It's too late by that stage. Price is too high. So think about those things, because we see more and more evidence of it, and we see it on social media, because You can't hide on social media anymore, right? People are stupid enough to put out a request to find out where a journalist's kids go to school, what their car registration is. The minute that starts happening, people should be arrested by the state. This is intimidation. In fact, just 2 days ago, a new bill was promulgated, and this is interesting information for anyone who cares, about what it is illegal to do on social media now because of this new bill.
Is this a bill made in South Africa?
Yeah, you can go to mybroadband.co.za and you can read the bill. Three types of Facebook and WhatsApp messages that can now land you in jail. The National Assembly passed the Cyber Crimes and Cybersecurity Bill, which introduces new laws about social media messages with penalties that include up to 3 years in jail. There are three kinds of messages that can result in a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 3 years. First of all, a message which incites damage to property or violence, which is what the EFF has been doing all week.
Yeah.
A message which threatens persons with damage to property or violence, just threatening.
Yeah.
And finally, a message which unlawfully contains an intimate image. So again, if you are the kind of person who uses revenge porn,
okay,
you can go to jail.
So even if it's of yourself?
Even if it's of yourself.
Wait.
Go to jail.
If I send a naked picture of myself.
And it's used by someone else, then they could end up going to jail. If they spread that around and embarrass you.
Of course you can't send nudes anymore.
No, you, Sia, don't worry. We're not going to spoil.
You're safe, Sia.
Sia's dating game almost took a knock there.
Yeah, geez, what else was I meant
but,
to
but
do?
Remember, this is what people have been saying for the longest time. Even retweeting a tweet that contains malicious content could be a criminal offense. Even if the Twitter user didn't see it as an endorsement, and even if they delete it afterwards. So if you're doing this stuff online,
you've got to think carefully, huh?
You could be arrested. So go ahead and spread that around rather than spreading revenge porn and threats of imminent violence. All right, enough of the serious stuff. Please. It's a Tuesday morning. We don't want to be too serious. We've got Proudly South African coming in a little while with two businesses that I think you're going to want to know about. But before we do any of that, Leanne's got some things she wants to tell us about today. 10 orphans from Swaziland helped to write a prize-winning movie?
Yes. The movie is called Liana, which I understand to mean it is raining.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. It is a beautifully animated in 3D film.
Yes.
Which started off with a bunch of documentary makers.
Yes.
The filmmakers Aaron and Amanda Kopp.
Yeah.
They were going to make a documentary about children in the New Life Homes Orphanage in Eswatini, which is formerly known as Swaziland.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Aaron grew up in Eswatini, and he had met some of the youngsters before he started filming in way back in 2010. But when the cops started on their movie, they realized that these kids could make up their own story. And so that's what happened. It was like an organic thing. 10 of the orphans, aged 9 to 12, created a character named Liana and sent her on an adventure. They were guided by South African storyteller Glina Mhlophe.
We all know Glina Mhlophe.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
She's great.
The movie is a curious hybrid, it's described as. There are brief scenes of the real orphans working to tell their story, interspersed with animated segments about Liana, who lives in a stick and mud house that's painted blue. Clad in a sunny yellow dress, Liana embarks on a perilous quest to save her younger brothers from thieves who've kidnapped them. She travels through mountains and forests and runs into many obstacles, including a monster.
A monster?
The monster is alive.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it had its world premiere at the LA Film Festival last year.
Sounds beautiful.
And went to release in the US in their fall, so just recently.
Mm-hmm.
It has won so far over 20 awards, including the Grand Jury Award for Best Documentary at the LA Festival and the Night Documentary Achievement Award. And, who knew that it was all put together with the help of actual little orphans?
Fantastic.
That's sweet.
That is sweet. Shows you. There's creativity everywhere. Mm. SpaceX have apparently launched the biggest U.S. rideshare mission with 64 satellites. Now, how does this work? SpaceX is part of Elon Musk's group of companies, right?
Yes. And SpaceX has launched a Falcon 9 rocket from California, carrying 64 small satellites into low orbit around the Earth. And it's being dubbed the largest ever ride share mission.
But it doesn't mean you're going to get a ride on a satellite.
No, it means that 34 different companies, including government agencies, universities, the University of Illinois, they have all put their own little satellites onto this Falcon rocket, and so that they can send all of their satellites into orbit. So they're just hitching a ride.
But it's a huge ride.
It was a huge collaboration. You can imagine 34 different companies.
So one big satellite, and then all of these are like spiders coming out of a nest.
Oh,
little satellite. Why that analogy?
It does sound like that.
That sounds like that,
like
right?
Like when you open up one of those nests and all these little spiders come out. Yeah.
That's what it is. All these little satellites. Mm. So cool.
And of course, the mission had to beat India, because India fired a rocket just days ago carrying 31 satellites into space. So now this is the biggest ride share.
All right. I found an interesting site called worlddata.info. What they do is they collect reports and research from all over the world, and then you can basically look up anything about countries, and it measures up country to country.
Interesting things. Exciting, yeah.
So do you want to know which country has the tallest people?
Can we guess?
Can we guess?
Of course you can guess. Go on.
Somewhere
Netherlands.
Europe. Yeah, I was going
spot
to
on, Leanne. Netherlands.
How did you know?
Average height of a man in the Netherlands is 1.83 meters. The average height of a woman is 1.69 meters.
And I can tell you from experience, being tall doesn't mean having...
Oh, we weren't going to go there, but that's fine.
Big shoes. It doesn't mean that.
Huh. Do you want to know which country has the fattest men?
United States of America.
American Samoa. Oh. Out in the South Pacific.
Oh. Yeah, there's men Samoans who wear the little straw dress skirts.
Right. That's the ones. And you know which country has the fattest women? American Samoa.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Fat, happy people. Nation.
Very fat people in American Samoa. Thinnest people?
Japan.
Who do you think?
I don't know.
Thinnest men live in Timor-Leste, which is... Timor is, of course, in the... it's near Australia. It's between Australia and Asia. Timor is an island.
Well, I hope it's not because they're hungry. I hope it's just because they're healthy.
Well, it might be because they weigh 54.3 kilograms on average.
Goodness,
so that's quite thin.
It also could be like a genetic evolution thing.
They have the thinnest men and the thinnest women, and they have an average BMI, body mass index, of 21.2.
These are my people.
Yes, very thin like you, Sia.
Maybe you that's where you're from.
Did you just look them up?
Yes, I'm like, okay. I can see a bit.
Ask your mum if she knows anyone from Timor.
All right, how about countries with the biggest and the worst life expectancy? Because they compare all these countries. You can actually arrange them by order.
Worst life expectancy,
somewhere
I would suggest,
in Africa.
Death due to either AIDS or fatness.
Okay, well, let me do it for you this way. Male life expectancy.
Yeah.
So men in this country live the longest. Hong Kong. And remember, Hong Kong's regarded as a separate country because it used to belong to Britain. Now it's part of China, but it's actually kind of not. They don't really follow the rules of men in China in every way. Mm. Hong Kong, 81.3 years. Average life expectancy for a man.
That's too long.
And life expectancy for a woman, also Hong Kong, 87.3 years.
Even longer.
Mm. Yes. So women live longer than men. Then let's go down the list. So the best countries to live if you want to live a long time, or the best countries to be born in if you want to live a long time, Hong Kong, Japan, Macau, and then Spain. France?
Yes, I've heard this about Spain.
Yeah. What France, then Spanish? South Korea, then Switzerland, then Singapore, then Bermuda, then Italy.
Spain is the Mediterranean diet. I actually read an article really recently, very recently, of Spain having longevity because of their diet.
Which country is the worst to live in if you want to live a long life? Where should you not be?
Rwanda.
No, Rwanda's quite good, actually, Sia.
Oh.
How dare you?
Give us a clue, continent.
Well, Africa, but Central African Republic is the particular country that's not great to live in.
And
average age, 50.3 years. Average.
Do you think it's due to disease?
No, it's war, it's
crime,
disease.
War crimes.
It's got, there's a huge amount of conflict in that part of the world. There's religious war, there's ethnic cleansing. There's a lot of terrible stuff that happens in the Central African Republic. The other countries that have terrible life, and here's something at number three from the bottom, that you should be worried about. Central African Republic is the worst for men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then Sierra Leone. Then Lesotho.
Goodness.
Only a life expectancy average of 51.7 years for men and 56.4 years for women.
What happens in Lesotho? That's so
bad. I don't know, but it's not good for life expectancy. Maybe the altitude, who knows? Then Chad, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, Swaziland, Somalia, Burundi, Guinea-Bissau and South Sudan. So all African countries in the bottom. And if you're a woman, the worst country is Sierra Leone.
You want to know some more? Also have a lot to deal with the availability of medical assistance and hospitals.
Right. It could be. Could be all of those things. There's a number of factors they take into consideration. So let's look at the cost of living. Where do you think it's the most expensive to live?
My mind immediately goes to the UK, to the big cities in the UK.
No. Actually, the cost of living index would show that Bermuda is the most expensive place to live.
Why? Because your money disappears into the triangle.
Well, apparently the purchasing power index is 100.9 and the monthly income average in a country like Bermuda is $8,845. And that is expensive. I mean, you use up all of that just to live.
Yeah.
So Bermuda. Next up, Mozambique. Very
That's
expensive.
A surprise.
Yep, very expensive to live in Mozambique because goods are hard to come by and they're expensive and they have to import a whole lot of stuff. Then Switzerland. But isn't that interesting? Mozambique's number two.
Yeah.
Then Switzerland, then Iceland, then the Bahamas, Nicaragua, Norway, Denmark, Australia, Kosovo, Luxembourg. Those are the most expensive countries to live in.
I know people who've just moved to Mozambique.
Yes. Do you know what the cheapest countries are to live in?
No.
India. India is the cheapest. Pakistan, Ukraine, Egypt, Moldova, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Nepal, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Syria, and
cheapest
Macedonia.
Cheapest in the world.
Cheapest to live. Yeah.
India.
India is the cheapest country in the world to live. Did you know that?
Well, what sort of factors into a statement like that?
Okay, well, I'll tell you since you've asked.
Yes, thank you.
The cost of living, periodically calculated in nearly representative baskets of consumer goods. So in other words, if you had to fill a trolley with bread, milk, water, if you need bottled water, some fruit and veg, some basic stuff.
Toilet paper.
They compare that basket of stuff across all the countries.
Okay.
And in India, it would be the cheapest to fill your basket of stuff.
Okay.
You want one more?
Sure.
I'll let you choose. You can have IQ.
Oh, I already want that.
I need to know that.
Yeah.
I need to know that.
Or you can have average income. Which one do you want?
IQ.
You want IQ?
No doubt.
All right.
This is going to be...
This is going to upset a lot of people, all right? Because what they do is they take the average of the results of 9 international studies and compare them to the average income and government expenditures on education for the years from 1990 to 2010.
Okay, I was going to say, how does education factor into it?
It does.
Because you're all born with a certain intelligence level, but education can increase that.
Correct. So the question of intelligence may be controversial. In fact, intelligence is influenced by national, political, and geographic factors. Often surprisingly, but scientifically proven, a warmer climate has a markedly bad influence on intelligence. Isn't that interesting?
It's like having your balls out in the sun. It's not a good idea.
With an average IQ of 98 points, the USA is only 27th in the ranking.
Ooh.
With 108 points, the inhabitants of Singapore are the highest intelligence quotas worldwide. The last place with only 56 points. 56. Now, do you realize, like, IQ, I mean, it's very flawed, right? People, not everybody believes IQ is a great metric for measuring intelligence, but it's all we've got. So let's look at it. 100 is meant to be average. So if you have an IQ of between 90 and 110, you're considered average in intelligence. Over 110, you get, you know, people who are of superior intelligence, then you get markedly superior intelligence, then you
even
get
cleverer.
Genius.
Cleverest.
And going backwards from that, you go anything below 70 is regarded as being feeble-minded. Then you get, these are actual terms, a moron. A moron is regarded as someone with an intelligence of below 60.
Oh, no. Okay.
Below 50,
you get
an imbecile.
So these are actual terms.
Yes.
That's where they come from.
And below 40, an idiot. Idiot's the dumbest you can be.
Wow, I think the term imbecile is...
It's a good one, right? So, listen to this. I mean, if Equatorial Guinea has an average IQ of 56, they're the dumbest country in the world, according to this. That means that all of the people in Equatorial Guinea are imbeciles.
Oh, no, it's terrible. But it's...
They're obviously going to be some outliers.
That's what the scale says.
They're going to be some outliers. So there'll be people with 100, and there'll be people with 120 in Equatorial Guinea. So it doesn't mean that everyone in Equatorial Guinea is dumb, but the average is not good. And remember, these are the people who had Teodoro Obiang Nguema as their president for all of their lives, because he's been there for like 50 years.
Oh, dear.
So, if someone tells you they're from Equatorial Guinea, don't hire them. And this is interesting. The U.S. Army will not take you if you have an IQ below 85.
No.
Yes, not because they think...
You might fire the bazooka wrong.
But because you're actually dangerous to the other people around you.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, goodness me.
Not because they want you to do complex tasks and figure out difficult calculations or any of that stuff, but because you actually could be dangerous to the people around you. The U.S. Army use that as a metric, and they throw out some 3 million people every time.
Wow, they're a lot of
idiots. I didn't know you had to do an IQ test.
Sorry. So they throw out a whole bunch of people that represent effectively 3 million people in the country that are under 85 IQ.
Well, right. Do think about it practically. You are in the line of fire.
Right.
And you go, John, grab the bazooka. John.
Yeah.
No. I don't know what to do. My brain hurts.
He might, you know, it's happened to me. I've jumped into a hockey game and scored for the wrong team. Yeah. I mean, it could happen with these imbeciles.
Listen, we're all stupid some of the time, right?
Yeah,
but there is a way to measure, and if you've ever done an IQ test, what it is pattern recognition. So it doesn't have to do with education. It's not to do with how much you've learnt. It's to do with your inherent abilities to recognize patterns. You know, they put the blocks in a certain order.
Yeah, you've got to finish the sequence.
Yeah, you've got to say what's next. And this is basic intelligence. So there are different ways they measure it. But Equatorial Guinea's at the bottom and Singapore's at the top. Singapore average IQ is 108. Do you know what South Africa's average IQ is?
Uh-oh.
Okay, go.
77. Not
so
good.
So we're not even normal.
No, we're normal.
We're below 90.
We're not... Okay, below 70, they say feeble-minded, but we're below average. So we're not smart. South Africans aren't... By and large, we're not a smart nation.
What does between 70 and 90 mean? It's just average.
Average.
Well, you know what? I'm
below
actually...
Below average.
I'm happy being here then, because then at least I feel remotely intelligent. Well, imagine in Singapore, I'd be
the dumbest person.
The dumbass, yeah.
So in other words, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed is
king. Yes, exactly.
No, I definitely know I'm South African, not from Timor-Leste, because I'm just below average.
Yeah, well, there we go. So
I feel at home here.
If you were feeling full of yourself this morning, just remember you're in a country where the average IQ is 77. And that's not even so bad, because Equatorial Guinea's at 56.
Goodness me. How are they surviving? How are they running like grocery stores and businesses?
Shame.
How are they able
must be
to,
so hard.
How are they able to just cross the road?
Well, don't worry. Saudi Arabia is only at 81.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, that's because of the heat.
Nepal's at 77, just like us. Afghanistan's at 80. We've been beaten by Afghanistan in the IQ stakes. I mean,
that's
embarrassing. But there we go. All right, so...
Yeah, very interesting.
Some useful comparisons between countries. Some people are very uncomfortable about that stuff, but there it is. You can't lie. That's research. The facts don't care about your feelings. Something to think about. All right, well, let's be proudly South African about the things we can be proudly South African about. We have some brilliant people in this country and some very innovative, very thoughtful, very entrepreneurial people.
Yes, indeed.
We've led the world in so many ways, right? We've got exports of terrifically successful South African products. We've got people who've come up with brilliant ideas that have gone international too. And by any metric, we compare very favorably on that scale. And by no means are our guests this morning any exception to that rule. Sibusiso Mkhwanazi, I'm very excited to welcome to the studio, is an experienced industrial designer with a demonstrated skill in concept development, design thinking and product development. In developing competitive products, he believes in a human-centered design approach, which is a process that focuses on the needs of the end user, resulting in solutions that are tailor-made to suit their needs. He's got a business called Sintu Design.
Okay.
Want to hear about it?
Yes.
Sintu Design is a diverse industrial design studio with multidisciplinary experience in product development. So they give businesses the opportunity to conceptualize products and services for the market by designing and developing them. Let's say you've got an idea. Let's say you want to build a new kind of lift.
Yeah.
In a building. But you don't know how to do the actual design. Let's say you've got the idea of how it should work mechanically, or maybe you've got the idea of what it should look like, but you need someone to help you with the design. Well, this is what the Sintu Design Studio can help you do. They are behind the Sketchathon SA program, which was created with the purpose of educating and training the youth of South Africa in design, concept sketching, and prototyping. They've offered the program to Investec, SABS Design Institute, Junior Achievers South Africa, for the youth enterprise development programs. And he's here this morning. Sposiso, how are you, man? Nice to see you. Very, very well done on all your success so far.
Thank you so much. How are you doing,
guys? Very good. First of all, he's wearing a very loud and individual hat this morning.
Yes.
That's better than Pharrell's, I'll tell you that much.
Is it? Thanks a lot.
Big time.
Local brand.
Is it also local?
Yep.
Very good. Who is it? Give them some credit.
Simon and Mary.
Oh, Simon and Mary. Yeah. Very good. Well, listen, Sputsi, so how did you get into design?
Well, I've been in it for a very long time. Even at school, I went to an art school, so I've been doing it for about, I think, more than 12 years.
Were you always creative as a kid?
Yeah, always. So even
were you drawing and building?
Yeah, I was that guy with the sketchbook and pencils, coloring pencils. So I've been doing it for a very long time, and yeah, it's just a passion that I had.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So what made you decide to turn it into a business? Because that's a whole different thing. You know, most creative people happy to sit and draw stuff, and some of it happens and some of it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But to turn it into a business, very different.
Yeah, I think I was just frustrated working in a corporate environment. So what I wanted to do is just try something new. And the advantage of the space that I was at that time is that we got to work with entrepreneurs. So it was product development 101. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to expand more and just try something new. I think the second reason is that my parents are from an entrepreneurial background.
Oh yeah, what did
they
do?
They're in the hospitality space, so restaurants, food, that's their thing.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that they come from an entrepreneurial
background—that's hard work, huh?
Yeah.
You're lucky you weren't drafted in. Did they ever call you up and say, "Come, you've got to come and work in the family businesses"?
Well, I think my first job, I worked in the family business,
waitering, cooking,
all of that.
Cleaning,
all of that stuff. But they're very supportive with the art stuff. I mean, it makes sense. Got this restaurant thing going, then you're also supposed to follow through. But they're like, no man, just live your dream.
Well, that's nice, because most parents would just use their kids as like cheap labor. But it is hard. I mean, if you've ever been in a restaurant, things get pretty hairy.
Yeah, they do.
And it'll teach you very quickly the meaning of hard work.
Yep, that's true. I think the best way of quantifying my hard work was through the tips. So I remember they'd say, no, they're tipping him because he's a young guy, plus I've got a baby face, you know. So, like,
turn on the charm.
That's right. You got what you wanted out of these people.
I got it,
right?
Definitely.
So, okay, in design, I'd imagine it's a very competitive space because you've got people who are established, mm-hmm. who've got businesses that have been around for much longer than yours. Mm-hmm. How do you attract the business? How do you attract it, and how do you keep it?
I think it's based on what you're offering, right? Second thing is that design is very, very expensive in terms of the service offering.
Sure.
But now you need to consider your end user, like I think you mentioned now.
Yeah, you talk about the human-centric thing. We'll get to that in a second. But
so it's just basically, what are you offering, and what's the value that I'm offering?
Right.
So it's not always a price thing, but I think it's pure value that I'm able to sort of compete against the big guys. I think the toughest obstacle is network. You know, they say network's everything. So it's just trying to find that balance, basically, when it comes to that.
What is a human-centric approach? I mean, do you put the actual person in there, and when you're designing something, look at like the distance from their arm to their head? And is it that sort of thing? Is it that literal, or is there a figurative part to this?
It could be.
As well?
Let me use you as an example, right?
Okay.
I don't know how many hours you spent sitting in that chair. But what it entails in terms of understanding what the problem is, or what solution I need to come up with, I need to literally put myself in your seat, spend a good, let's say, 10 hours in your seat, obviously engaging you, understanding what the pain is, you know.
Right.
And then that's the point of discussion. Then from there now I can actually go out and start developing products. So I might consult with a physiotherapist
mm-hmm.
to get their advice. What causes this? What is the current solution? Then we develop a product based on that.
That's amazing. What are your products that you're most proud of?
Well, not necessarily my products. So it's to say entrepreneurs that I've worked with.
Right.
I think it's the impact of the products. We were speaking earlier on about a product that we developed. It's like a electromagnetic generator. And this is a product for the mining sector, right? So how can we harvest energy from the conveyor belt? You know, there's the rollers. So that's basically it, developing a product like that. I don't know how many times I dropped the main switch, probably fried a circuit board here and there. But it was worth it. It's all part of the learning. I'm learning how to solder all of that stuff. So it's pretty fun.
So you're becoming a part-time electrical engineer as well.
Yeah, you have to be everything.
Everything.
Yeah, right. You have to be everything.
But design is such an all-encompassing category.
Mm-hmm. It's quite diverse. Even in industrial design, there's furniture design, automotive design, furniture design. It's so broad.
Yeah.
But as part of your training, the foundation, you can just become anything. As long as you can create. It's the key thing.
Are you one of those designers who has beautiful spaces around you most of the time? Like you insist on living and working in a certain kind of environment.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you do.
The offices here, I could work here.
You couldn't work here?
No, I would.
Oh, you could? Thank
and
God.
It's because of that fridge over there.
Yeah. I thought you were going to tell me that it looked like crap and you needed to come in here and fix everything.
I think it's a very refreshing environment. You want that.
Well, we'll talk about something called My Desk, which is who our next guest is involved with. A revolutionary wheelie school bag that converts into a desk and a chair, both at home and at school. You know how we often talk about how...
Firstly, just a wheelie school bag. I think of how many years I carried those heavy bags on my shoulders.
Yeah, and look at you now. You've got a hunchback and everything. I mean...
My right side's lower than my left.
This is tremendous. And we've got Farana Boudram here, who is from My Desk, and we're going to meet her in a second. But I'm fascinated by the fact that this thing is already indirectly and directly addressing 6 of the world's sustainable development goals in accordance with the 2030 agenda. It's a patented product. It's been recognized internationally. And the owner, Farana, has been selected as a global ambassador. So welcome to you, first of all.
Thank you very much, Gareth. It's great to be here.
What a pleasure to see you. So this is it comes in a, like, it almost looks like a tiny little trolley. And inside it is a desk, a chair, everything.
Yes. It's a school bag. It can be used as a shoulder bag and a wheelie bag.
She's busy unpacking it as we speak. And it's not even that complicated to make.
And it's a desk and chair. It's a school bag that converts into a desk.
Yeah.
For kids in the rural areas especially.
Right.
That don't have desks. So this solves them having a desk and a chair at school and at home. And the idea is to supply it with a solar light so they have a light as well while they work.
That's absolutely incredible. This solves so many problems.
Thank you. There's actually 3 million kids in South Africa without desks in school. And 95 million in Africa, let alone the rest of the world.
So how
you can't work like that. No. It's impossible.
How did you come up with the idea and how did you come up with the design?
Well, quite honestly, it started out with my daughter's school science expo project.
Yeah.
My husband and daughter started with cat litter boxes and plastic beach spades.
Oh, wow.
And made it in the kitchen. It just was an amazing idea, which I took further, added the chair, the trolley part of it.
Yeah.
And then prototyped, patented.
That's absolutely incredible. So, I mean, how much can you make this for?
I would be selling it at 1,200 Rand, which is $100 per desk. But remember, it's a desk at school, a desk at home.
Sure.
As well as a chair. So in comparison to to what's on the market, there isn't actually any competition.
What do you think of that design? Hey, Spusiso?
I'm thinking engineering right now.
it's pretty impressive, huh?
Yeah, I think as a system, it works very nice. I'm just wondering how you'd manufacture it and all of that. That's what's on my mind.
I would manufacture it. The initial one was actually rotational molded.
Okay.
And I realized that the time that it takes to produce is way too long and we wouldn't be able to keep up with the demand. So we went the route of injection molding that we plan on getting started up. Plans are done, prototypes are done. It's almost on the brink, and it's going to be assembled by a plant of women and disabled people.
Only. Oh wow! So you're even managing to do good there.
I'm trying.
It's terrific. So tell me about how Proudly South African has helped both of your businesses.
I'm fairly new with Proudly South African, so this is actually my first
interaction. Very good. Well, we're thrilled that we could be part of your virgin experience with them.
Thank you. So, and I look forward to the journey ahead.
Sure.
Look, I have had offers from abroad to have it manufactured there, but I feel very strongly about making a difference and ensuring that we as South Africans are seen in the rest of the world as a country that can. And the intention is to set up very much a first world plant.
That's terrific.
That South Africa can be proud of and bring the rest of the world to see.
And how about you, Spasiso?
Oh, I just got goosebumps.
I think
in terms of Proudly SA, I think let me start with why I actually joined.
Yeah.
I just saw a big opportunity with South African products, and considering I've worked with South African products, I just got inspired, you know. South Africa has amazing products. Sure, I've seen a ton of good products. So I wanted to contribute as much as I may benefit, but I think it's more of the contribution part that's really going to excite me.
And what do you think of the climate at the moment for entrepreneurs? You're both brave enough to have started your own thing. People often complain and go, oh, the economy's not great, and oh, it's so hard. And isn't that exactly the time you should be starting a business?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Look, at the end of the day, my product is going to solve problems for future generations, actually break that cycle of poverty at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, this is something that I feel very strongly about, and I know it's going to change the world. It is very difficult as an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
Funding is almost impossible, as much as, I mean, I'm an entrepreneur for 18 years in the mining industry.
Wow.
It's difficult to get buy in because
you don't look old enough to have been in the mining industry for 18 years.
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
It is. It certainly is.
I feel very strongly about this, but I must admit it is very difficult to get support in South Africa.
Mm.
As much as this is a product that's going to solve many problems,
right,
it's also going to create employment, it's still difficult to break through regarding funding.
Mm. Of course. But you know what? They always say that the easiest thing to get is money. The rest is the harder part, the business plan, the actual product, the staff, the cash flow situation, all of that kind of thing. But tell me, how do you think the industry that you're in, Farana, would change if we could all buy local?
The industry meaning education or mining?
Well, education, mining, but more especially the manufacturing stuff that you're going into now. How do you think that would improve if people decided to buy a local product rather than an international one?
Look, in that way, they would support the business, which would allow for me to employ more people, increase capacity, create more jobs, as well as, look, I'm looking at the foundations and sponsorships to actually buy the bag for the children, because obviously they can't afford it.
Sure.
So I think that's going to have a huge impact on South Africa itself.
But you mentioned the rest of the continent too.
Look,
I mean, that represents a huge market for you.
There's an absolute demand, and having been selected as a global ambassador, I have a great network. I would like to start in South Africa, which I'm on the brink of doing. Mm-hmm. But yes, I definitely plan on scaling to the rest of the world. And I foresee it making a huge difference to South Africa as far as generating income into the country, as far as creating job opportunities.
Growth, growth, growth.
All the way.
That's what we need.
And, you know, helping the disadvantaged, meaning women and disabled people, as well as children from the rural areas.
Sure.
So it's going to make
a
difference.
It's a virtuous cycle.
Yes. Mm. And 6 sustainable development goals, complying
Absolutely.
To 6 of them.
So it's My Desk, MIDESK. And we'll give you the info about where you can find out more on proudlysa.co.za in a minute. But how about you, Sposiso, when it comes to what you'd like people to know and remember and act upon with respect to Proudly South African products, goods, designs, ideas. How do you feel people should get involved or start to support?
I think from my point of view, the fact that we have South African products that we can work with and support, that's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
And second is the impact of doing so. So I think one of the problems is that we're positioning ourselves in a space where we're competing with products and trying to mimic them.
Yes.
And what usually happens as a result, we just get all the dumped products. So they come dump them here, right. Basically, right?
Cheap, easily broken, rubbish, nasty, exactly. Mass-produced. Yeah,
so that's that. But I think then if we're supporting local businesses, for starters, I don't think 2018 would have been a rough year for me as a business. And I'm not going to blame it on the economic, you know, it's part of the journey as a business. But yeah, I think it's great. It's an exciting time, truth be told, with South African products. And yeah,
I agree with you.
Well, it's a great pleasure to meet you both. Thank you for coming to share your time with us this morning. For more information on Proudly South African, you can visit proudlysa.co.za, or you can visit their new online store for only locally made products. Go to www.rsamade.co.za. Our guests this morning, Sibusiso Mkhwanazi and Farana Boodram. It's a pleasure to meet you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Proudly South African. .co.za, proudlysa.co.za if you want to find out more. We have got a fascinating guest coming in to join us in just a little while. His name is Trevor Watkins, and we'll talk about the individualist movement and whether or not you're one of those people who likes to belong, or you're like me, where you actively don't like to belong and you rebel against belonging, then he's maybe the guy that you need to talk to and you need to hear from this morning. All of that's coming up in just a little while. Stick around, cliffcentral.com. You know what to do. 0861-555-189 if you want to talk to us, if you've got something on your mind. Big thank you to our guests this morning from Proudly South African. And I hope that that you've learned something about what's going on in South African industry and the South African economy and people who are making a difference right now, not waiting for something to happen.
This is CliffCentral.com.